Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
どこにいるのかな。見えないよ。
あ、こんなところ。
What's good, Internet? It is June 30th, 2017, and you are listening to Waypoint Radio, episode 76. Episode 76. It's us. It's me, Austin Walker. That was Patrick Klepek yelling a second ago for some reason. I'm not quite sure what the reason was.
What, you're allowed to get psyched at the beginning of a podcast, but
no,
I can't
fine.
Bring the noise?
It's fine. You're allowed. You're allowed to get psyched. Why are you psyched?
Psyched?
Why are you psyched today? Danielle Rando, are you psyched?
I'm so psyched.
That's good. It's good
I'm
to be psyched.
Super psyched.
Not as psyched
it's
as
like
Patrick.
The, it's like the last major thing we have to do, and then like we're coasting for the rest of Friday.
Basically.
We have 4-day weekend.
4-day weekend.
Oh, my God. Burr,
burr, burr, burr, burr. 4-day weekend. What are you doing for the 4-day weekend? Call in and win tickets to the Mr. Worldwide Pitbull Show.
Oh.
Where Pitbull's going to be playing PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds.
Burr,
burr,
That'd
burr,
be cool.
Burr, burr, burr.
I would watch... I
no.
would watch a celebrity like Twitch stream that was just a bunch of like Pitbull-esque celebrities. Cisco, who else would
Cisco?
Cisco falls into Pitbull like for you.
Place.
Fred Durst. Fred Durst.
Fred Durst is no Pitbull, sir.
Yeah, I don't
one
know
of
about
the
this.
Several of the members of Slipknot in costume
as Pitbull.
No, they're just part. They're
just in their
part,
own.
They're
in their
streaming.
Where's the pit bull? Where's the pit bull here? That's what I need to know. What's the pit bull angle on Slipknot?
I think
I'm just. I want a bunch of shitty celebrities playing Battlegrounds.
I'm gonna put this on the internet, and people are gonna be mad at you for shit talking Pitbull. Pitbull brings joy to people. He likes butts a lot, I believe. I read
there's
that.
There's like multiple.
I mean, so does Cisco.
There's multiple layers
fair.
Of irony going on right now.
Okay,
like I can't.
Like
I can't deal. I can't deal with the onion irony.
The onion irony. Yeah, there it is. It is June 30th. It's the end of June. We've made it through June. That means we are now kind of out of the shadow of E3 and into the summer proper, which means that we are maybe in a little bit of a summer slump in terms of what new game releases are out there. There's a couple new things. I played a little Ever Oasis. I don't think that's super good. Mike Diver wrote about it, for the site. And it's just like not super charming. I don't even want to like, I want it to be really charming.
It? I don't even know what it is.
So it's by one of the people behind the, Mana series. And it is like an action RPG with some kind of town building elements. You build out an Oasis kind of trading post by bringing in new like citizens who then open up shops, and it just doesn't have it. It just doesn't have the like charm of something like Fantasy Life or Dark Cloud or you know similar games that are about building out your home and then going kind of diving into a dungeon. Rune Factory, like there's a bunch of games that do charm, that do that sort of like you're building a place and also you're going out into the world with a sword and shield and you're fighting stuff. And it just doesn't have it. And that was frustrating for me. But other than that, I don't know that I've been playing anything else super new. And I don't know. The schedule just seems kind of light right now. What are y'all up to?
Well, it's perfect for dipping your toe into a little DLC.
That's
like,
true.
Yeah, the DLC pool, you know, if you want to have a little pool party.
The Dilk pool.
With your, yeah, the, the Dilk pool.
Maybe it's a soft C. Dilse. The Dilse pool.
Is that what you're calling
it? Is it the Dilse pool or the Dilk pool?
The Dilse pool of Batwa. Breath of the Wild. DLC came out today, and I bought it twice because I have this game on my Switch and on my Wii U.
Ah.
My like main playthrough,
yes,
is on my Wii U.
Yes.
I played this entire thing on the whatever gamepad,
the,
Wii U
gamepad. Wii U gamepad, yeah. So this DLC is the hard one, right? Is that?
Yes, it's like hard mode. There's a master quest. There is a Tingle outfit, and there are secret surprises. I have not yet gotten the secret surprises because the thing I'm most excited about, and the thing I've been playing on and off kind of today,
is the Tingle costume. You love the Tingle costume.
You know, I truly am Tingle. That is my fursona, I think. Did I do it right?
I think it's your Tingle sona. I think we all have a Tingle Sona, and it's just Tingle for all of us.
We all have a little Tingle.
You all got a little Tingle in you. Yeah.
So what's the thing? What's the actual thing that you're excited about?
The actual thing is the, and I forget exactly what it's called, but it's a map function that shows you everywhere you've been. It shows you every path you've taken.
Called the Hero's Path, actually. So there you go.
Hero's Path. I was close. Very, very happy about it. I have found, and I have put in close to 200 hours to this game. I haven't actually looked at my... whatever actually tells you how many hours, but I have close to everything, basically, and have been also just playing a lot of it.
But you haven't beaten the game, right? You haven't beaten Ganon?
No, I've not actually been to Ganon yet, which, you know, I should. I have a weird thing with finishing things that I really like. It's hard sometimes. You just want to spend a lot of time in that world. I understand that I probably should just do it because you can just kind of go back to the game. Mm-hmm. It's not like it really changes. So I will probably do that this weekend. But I won't put it to bed because the DLC is so much fun and I am finding so much new stuff. I found like a new, not just a shrine, but a new, like a special fountain. I don't want to say too much, but there are special fountains. Yeah, in the game that you can sort of find. There's like a special significance to it, and it was really exciting. And there's like a whole section of the map, basically in the jungle area, in the jungle biome, that I was like, oh my God, I've never been here.
That's the best feeling.
You know, oh, it's so good.
Did the new map DLC, like, let you find that because you realized you'd never been to a certain place?
Exactly. Yeah, that's and really I just cool. put a waypoint there, and I was like, oh, yes, perfect. I can now find every little corner I haven't been to. Right. Because I was actually going for that already, even before this came out. I was sort of like, all right, I want to name everything. Every, like, body of water. I want to make sure I find everything that has a name on this map. Right. And I was doing that just manually, and that got a little tedious after a while. Yeah. So, this has been a godsend. It is so much fun to see anything I haven't seen yet. And just really, I just, not like I needed an excuse to play more of this game because I've already put so much time into it. But, oh my God, it's just wonderful to be in this world and to find all those little hidden nooks and crannies to have that excuse.
Have you found the Trial of the Sword or whatever? Which is like the new...
I know where it is.
Okay.
It's strongly hinted at. I have the special sword that it is, that's part of the...
Sure.
The thing. I haven't gotten it yet, but that's going to be a this weekend thing. I'm very excited.
Gotcha. That's exciting. I really want to dig into that. And you haven't checked out Master Mode, right?
Not yet. I will, though.
This is, for people who don't know, the Master Mode is the hard mode that this game is adding. And I'm just going to read this is from a Forbes article breaking down what everything you need to know about Zelda Breath of the Wild's new Master of Trials DLC. So here's the stuff. It's not just buffing enemy stats. It's difficult enemies appear in new locations, such as, there are Lynels on the Great Plateau now.
Oh my God.
Which is
really?
Yeah. Enemies are ranked up. So traditionally red bokoblins are now blue, etc. Enemies have new tricks up their sleeves, like health recovery. They'll also spot you from further off. Nintendo is also promising other higher level enemies that you won't encounter in normal mode. You also only get one save file and one autosave file. And also there are floating rafts holding enemies and treasure chests, which have been spotted across Hyrule. So that's exciting.
I want the Lynels, but I don't know if I want everything else.
I want it all, baby. I want it to be difficult. I want it to be, this makes me want to start over and beat this game again, which is not a thing I ever do in my life. But here we are. Here we are.
Oh my God, I know. It's so good. It's hard to... It's hard to not just be very hyperbolic, but this game really, oh man.
Yeah.
It has a lot. It has a lot of layers. You know, back to the onion thing, there's a lot of layers there.
Pull those layers off and reveal, apparently, a red Nintendo Switch shirt for Link, which now is also on the Great Plateau. Yeah.
That's part of the hard mode. You actually have to finish the game only wearing the Nintendo Switch shirt.
The next vote for permadeath, only wear the Switch shirt. So.
Oh, God. Gives you negative stats.
The other new thing, too, is you can find a travel medallion, which is you can create a custom fast travel location anywhere, which is neat. That seems kind of cool.
Very useful.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, let me know more about that next week for sure, because, I mean, I'll have time to dig into that myself and report back on my end. Patrick, what about you? You been playing any video games?
That's, man, I just murder.
Just murder.
That's it.
Player unknown battlegrounds.
Player unknown's murder grounds.
Murder grounds.
Pitbull's unknown murder grounds.
That's okay. It. I feel like this is the game that we have now started playing in our free time, Patrick.
Well, that's the difference, is that for a couple of weeks, I thought, well, I'll only play when I'm playing with Austin in the morning, which started as a feature that was, it'll be one run that goes for like 15, 20 minutes.
What fools
then
we were.
Quickly ballooned into something that, you know, goes for essentially till they kick us out of the room that you record in. And now I have found myself in like the last two or three, a little before E3, I've started playing it at, like, it becomes the game I play for an hour and a half, 2 hours at night.
Yeah, before
the time
bed.
That I have before I have to go to bed. Because
it's
I start
not
thinking,
a good bedtime game. I want to put that out there. It's not.
Oh, I'm staying up so much later than I intend to. Like, I've been very disciplined since my daughter was born, because losing that discipline is punishing.
Yeah.
I am always trying to be in bed at midnight, because if I have to get up in the middle of the night, or like if other things like occur, like it's going to disrupt my sleep schedule, and that, especially early in the week, that can cause a real problem. Sleep is good.
Sleep
like,
is
you
great.
Sleep.
It's important. Yeah.
Yeah. Danielle, of course, would be on the pro sleep train. and I've started playing more of that. I'm starting to play with more friends, and like my thought being, like, what I'm learning and having experience with at night will, you know, hopefully feed into the stuff that we do in the morning. And it's just become my game. Like, that's, like, the only game. I've tried to break it. I saw what Mike wrote about this game called Get Even. It's a Namco. It's published by Namco. It's developed by some newer studio. It's kind of a throwback sort of like B game, like not B game in that it's like a B movie sort
a
of like
B-movie
schlocky.
The game. I got you. B movie with Jerry Seinfeld.
It's more than like it kind of, you know, has larger aspirations than maybe its mechanics can pull off, which is the sort of game that we don't really see as much anymore. And I was like, I should play a different game to like find other things to write about and not play PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds. And then I'll play it for 20 minutes and go, that's 20 minutes in which I could have played PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds. So I'm just... I've just decided
given
that's
in.
The game. I've just given in. Like, at some point, the fever will break on this game in a way that it does on any game that you play for.
Yeah.
I mean, at this point, I'm probably, you know, 40, 50 hours in that game, and that seems... I feel like I've barely scratched the surface of it,
I'm
even though I'm
53 hours in, and yeah, like you, it feels like that's nothing. It feels like, partially because I have friends who are just getting chicken dinners left and right, and which is terminology in PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds for getting a win. When you get a win, it says winner, winner, chicken dinner. And I've gotten two so far. Oh. But 2 in 53 hours is not very many. Like,
no,
matches take at most 40 minutes. So,
and that's if you survive, you know, roughly to the final bits. Like, you can, you know, anyone that's watched our streams knows that sometimes, you know, you're often rewarded for going into high trafficked areas, because you can both take out the high traffic areas tend to have the best loot. And so you can both loot from corpses, and also if you're able to take out folks, you can, you know, discover that loot for yourself. So matches can end, you know, minutes in, or it can go as long as 40. And so over 53 hours, you know, you've probably played 100, you know, like 200 matches probably.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
that seems
like
about right. And I find like I'm still learning things.
Yep.
I feel, we were talking about this when we were playing this morning, that I'm long over the original, like the hump of just wrapping my head around the basic. Like, I always kind of know what to do. Like, I know the arc of a match. I know sort of what I want to do on like a larger level. But there are still so many moment to moment, minute to minute, situational things, and sort of like emotional and psychological things that I'm figuring out, both in terms of interactions with players and in terms of how I interact with the world and how I interact with the people that I play with, and
right.
that my interactions with people like you are a lot different than when I'm playing like for the first time with Alex Navarro solo.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like we don't have the rapport in terms of playing that game. And so it's just all that stuff. I'm still learning so much.
I played with three of my friends last night. I played with two other members of Friends at the Table, and I played with another friend of mine just from Twitter and the internet. And I'd played with the two other people from Friends at the Table before, but I hadn't played with the other internet person. And the other internet person was a way more aggressive player than my other friends were. And I, you know, I love all these people, but it was one of these things like, oh shit, like this is not maybe, like, our styles are just not quite meshing yet. We need more time to like figure out how to be the right amount of aggressive versus the right amount of like kind of conservative. And right. in the end, we ended up finding our, like, the first game went bad. Like, the first game just it was bad. The second game, we ended up getting this great moment of, so for people who don't know, PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds takes place on the same map every game. It's this huge island. You know, it's actually a really big island. Maybe huge is the wrong word. Like, if you have a car, you can get across it pretty quickly, but it's still a pretty sizable island that's divided or that is filled with all of these interesting locations, right? So there's like a city that's flooded underwater. There's a power plant. There's a military base. And it has that great kind of, competitive multiplayer thing of like everybody just gets the terminology where you go, oh, do you want to do a tunnels game? Oh, do you want to, go to the power plant? Do you want to go where it's really spicy? Military base, right? And in this case, there's a quarry that I'd never really been to before. It's towards the southwest. I'd driven past it a bunch and seen it on the map as like a kind of like weird, like a striation of rocks and stuff on the map, but I'd never actually gone to it before. And so finally we came to it from the eastern side. And what ended up working really well was by this point, we kind of found the way to mesh together so that the mm-hmm. super aggressive guy was like up on the ridge looking down, while the more conservative players were like keeping low. And then like I was kind of in the middle zone because that's kind of where I'm at in my arc with PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds. And between the three of us or the four of us, we were able to like get sight on these people and ended up having this really cool firefight across like different layers because the quarry is like, it's a quarry. So there's like, it's a long, kind of crater in the ground that then has levels that go up, right? So it's like, oh, then up a little level and then like flat cliff face and then another levels out again and then another flat cliff face. And we ended up having this amazing gunfight that felt like something out of a movie. It felt like something out of like a book about, you know what I mean? Like I could imagine reading, a Tom Clancy novel about this gunfight or seeing the summer blockbuster action movie where those three layers are like the Jason Bourne movie or the James Bond movie where that's how the firefights happen. And that's part of why I just love this game so much is that when it happens right, the combat does not just feel like the way Call of Duty combat feels, the way Battlefield combat feels, partially because there's just death. Like you die, you have to start a new run. But like just being able to be like, okay, the territory is broken up in this way and the combat just ends up feeling so cinematic or the opposite, which is you get shot from somewhere and you don't know where it comes from. But I kind of like both of those things a lot.
I had this a moment when I played this more. My best run happened before playing with you.
Yeah, of course, of course.
And I was just getting warmed up before work, and so I was playing solo. I wasn't playing with a group. Like I guess for people that aren't fully aware, like you can play solo in which everyone is on their own. You are not partnered with anyone else. You can play duos in which the entire map is groups of two, in which you can either play with someone a friend on Steam, or you can get matched up with a random person and play with them. Although I've never done that, and God willing, I never will do that. That doesn't seem like a great way to play that game. And then there are squads, which I've often played in groups of three, but that means you're often going up against groups of four. Because just because you have three doesn't mean you're matched into other groups of three. It just means you are disadvantaged.
Yes.
And so I was playing a solo game, and there was a sequence towards the end where I was really advantaged in terms of how I was approaching where the circle was finishing. We were down to about like 11 people. I was getting shot at, and I jumped into the water, and they clearly didn't have a good sense of where I was. And so if you crouch underwater, you can kind of just swim underwater for about 30, 40 seconds. And I just hung out there. Mm-hmm. And then by that time, everyone had rushed over and was up on the top of this hill. And the hill was, steep enough that I could slowly crawl my way up, and kind of watch things play out without actually getting too involved. I could take pot shots. I killed two people as they were kind of trying to move into position. But anyway, within a couple of minutes, the circle had gotten – the size of my head. Like, it was basically it was incredible. There was nowhere to go. It was one-on-one. And both me and the other player were prone. So we're both laying on the ground. And if – either of us moved, it was going to give away our position. In Battlegrounds, you can both look around by, you know, shifting the mouse or moving on the keyboard. You can also hold Alt and you can look around you without actually shifting your position. So that often you want to be not moving, so you're not getting any sort of movement patterns away. Mm-hmm. But you can still look around you 360 degrees and get a sense of what is actually happening in the space around you. Neither of us wanted to move, and I found myself paralyzed. I'd never been in this. Often when I'm playing the game, I can look back on what have I done in the past? Like, how did we approach the situation before? That didn't go very well the last time. I never used grenades. Hey, maybe we should try that this time. I've been number two. I've never gotten a chicken dinner solo. I've only done it with a duo. And so I just sat there I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
I had no no tactics, no strategy, no vocabulary.
And, like, you hadn't failed even previously in a similar situation. Because, like, that's a huge part of this is, like, well, the last time I tried this, I did blank, and that didn't work out, so I guess I'll try Y. You know, like, and that is such a huge thing. And if you don't have those experiences, you just don't get better.
And so what ended up happening was I just sat there and thought, okay, maybe he's across the way. Maybe he'll blink first. And one of the things we talk about a lot when we've been playing is both of you and I tend to play a little too conservative and like need to find moments to produce – to be aggressive because you want to produce – you want the other person to blink, you want to charge them or knock them off psychologically.
There was a moment yesterday when I did the stream yesterday where – I had an Uzi with, like, a silencer and a stock on it, so it was, like, I had it upgraded, like, an extra clip or whatever, like, an extended clip, but the target that was in front of me was really far away, and I knew that if I charged at him to get into range, there would be just no way for me to get close enough without them seeing me first and then shooting me, so I just threw a grenade vaguely at them, and that drew their attention long enough for me to close the distance and, like, get the shots in, and it's just, sometimes that's all it takes. Sometimes all it takes is, like, throw a little oil onto the pan and make something splashy. Make a distraction. There've been lots of times when I've just said, Patrick, start shooting. Like, you're not, I'm being pinned down. Just start shooting in the air. It will throw them off. And that has saved my life so many times.
And so I'm sitting there, not showing what to do. And the person stood up, saw me on the ground, shot me in the head, and it was over. Like all that work, like all that tension, like over in an instant. And the lesson I took from it was, well, I should have done what that person did, was take, like, there's not a lot of strategy at this point. Like, you're just hoping you're going to stand up and be facing the correct direction where you'll be able to see someone, because that at least gives you a fighting chance that maybe you'll be facing the right way and be able to pull your gun out and fire. Whereas all I did was sit there and hope that they made a mistake. And often waiting for others to make a mistake is how you get yourself into a trap in which you don't sometimes you have to produce opportunities for yourself as opposed to waiting for them to present themselves. And I don't know.
There aren't a lot of games that do that or that demand that of you. Or, sorry, there are, but they're not the sorts of games that you and I often play.
Correct.
Like, I don't know, like, Danielle, you watched me play yesterday. And a thing that I was thinking about a lot while you were watching me play with, like, this different audience, right, it was just, like, I wonder if Danielle is seeing Breath of the Wild in this. I'm wondering if you're seeing, like, that style of open-ended, I need to find a solution for this problem, and that solution isn't just fast action, like good accuracy. It isn't just a gunfight. It's like actual problem solving.
Yeah, I definitely did, and it's very weird and interesting, but the way that you're describing it, Patrick, and the way you were both describing it a little bit earlier on, and of course I'm going to bring it back to this, but it reminds me of the way you train with, like, training partners in MMA
and
grappling class. Like, looking for openings and having sort of false openings, the way you're describing it right now is exactly what that game is all about when you're actually sort of grappling with someone. It's been described to me by people who know a lot more what they're doing about, like, trading vulnerabilities and sort of baiting people into making a move with vulnerabilities and then attacking that and knowing how to defend that, which is really interesting to me. And it's also very, very close to what you were talking about with, like, oh, you're playing with a new person and you're both getting so into this game that you're sort of learning those nuances and sort of getting this higher level of the game. And it's so different with other people.
Right.
And you have to sort of learn their boundaries and also learn what they're comfortable with and how they play. And it's, man, it's so fascinating. This game is fascinating.
The thing for me is, like, I'm trying to make sure that I don't just say, oh, this game is one of a kind because I mean I do feel like that. I feel like that. But sure. I also know that there are lots of people for which this sort of experience does come from other games and has come from Dota and from League of Legends and from
anything high enough level. Yes, when you get high enough level in a competitive game, exactly, right, you're going to feel that way, right? Yeah. About the give and take and sort of what it does and
but
what it doesn't.
This is just the first one that's brought me in this way to where like, if we finished all of our work today, I would so happily just play more of this game instead of going out to dinner with friends. Or, you know what I mean? Like, that's where right. I'm at, and I'm 53 hours in, which, again, does not happen that often. Like, I've loved shooters before. I like Destiny a whole bunch. I like the moment-to-moment feeling of that game. I played a lot of Halo in my time. I played a lot of Call of Duty in my time. But there's never been anything where I'm like, all I want to do is play another 30-minute round of this thing, you know?
And it's interesting, the group dynamics I find fascinating. Like, that's something that, you know, like you and I have developed over time as we've played, mm-hmm. you know, dozens of hours of this game together. And, like, the way we play is... other than being bad,
that's one.
Is but also like we both have a lot of input on the strategy. Like there's a lot of like give and take on what we're going to do next. Whereas, last week we played with Will Smith, a former a colleague of ours, who now does a VR show called The Foo Show. Mm-hmm. Find it on Steam. And he knows a lot more what he's doing, and he's also very good about giving not orders but no orders so like
yeah, he gives orders.
He essentially takes over, and it makes sense that he should take over because he knows more. He has a much better understanding of the map, of the meta. If you aren't aware of like the term meta, it's like the larger sort of like strategies or like patterns that are playing out across the game, that he just pays a closer attention to or is just more cognizant of, especially in the moment, than I am. And so part of the reasons I enjoy playing with him is I'm actually okay sort of like being subjugated and sort of just told like, hey, go do that, nice. Go do that. Cause he's correct. And it's actually fun to be told, hey, go up on that tree. I'm like, all right. Like,
yeah,
I
feel
like
tree.
I feel like I'm actually part of a squad in which, like, this person, it's like when when I'm playing, a video game in which I'm in charge of a squad and I'm, like, mm-hmm. assigning, like, go to this way, go that way, like, do this thing, do that thing. I feel a bit like that when I'm playing with Will because he has such a command over the game that I don't feel like I'm being told what to do in a sense that, like, oh, like, I know how to play this game. It's more like, no, like, that's probably the smart play. Yeah. Like, I'll play my role in the squad, and my role in this squad is, like, you know, putting down covering fire, mm-hmm. or whatever Will at the time thinks is the best move.
Well, and there's a relief with it, where it's like, mm-hmm. oh, yes. Thank Christ, I don't need to be the one who has to make this hard call. Somebody uh-huh. else gets to make this difficult call that could kill us all. And, like, sometimes it's even okay to be like, you know what? We got killed on somebody else's call. That sucks. But at least it wasn't me. At least I didn't lead us into disaster. And I'm being completely serious. Like, there have definitely been times – there's a risk-reward thing. Like, one of the bits that I think Patrick and I keep running into with me is when I'm behind the wheel of a car – I will often see an opportunity to slam into somebody with my car, an enemy player, or to like spin out and like hop out the car and shoot people. I think partially because our first kill ever came that way. And it's just like, mm-hmm. I have a deep feeling. I want that stuff. I want to relive our good times together, son. Also in this world, Patrick is my son, by the way. That is just, if you haven't been watching Breakfast in Battlegrounds, that is part of the ongoing fiction. And so like, that's one of those things. It's like, okay, every time I get into the car, I have to like tell myself out loud. I have to say to Patrick, okay, I won't slow down and try to get into a gunfight unless we agree to do that. But it's hard. It's so tempting always to just get into that sort of thing because if it goes well, you feel great. If you make the aggressive call or if you say, okay, let's go hide behind that tree and that tree is the right place to be, it can feel incredible. But mm-hmm. if you do the other thing and say, oh, well, let's be hyper aggressive or let's be too conservative and it all falls apart, like, it just, you feel like a shitty leader. And I don't know. It's a new feeling for sure for me in games. And I'm excited to keep playing it. The problem is I could keep talking about it forever. Like that.
I know. We should use that as a forced pivot to something else.
Yes, let's actually stop talking about this. Has anyone been doing anything else this week in terms of games, or in terms of anything else you want to talk about in the world of games?
I'm excited to play this Crash Bandicoot remaster.
Yeah.
Yeah, it came out today as we're recording this. I've downloaded it, but I have not had a chance to play it yet. But I have. Danielle, I know that you know, big fan of character platformers, as yeah. am I. I played a lot of the Crash Bandicoot games of the PS1 era. I sort of dipped out the moment Naughty Dog jumped off them and switched to Jack and Daxter, and then
yeah.
I heard some of the PS2 ones made by were actually like solid games. I just pretty much played the first three on the PS1, and then essentially followed Naughty Dog, and then started playing the. I really enjoyed the first two Jack and Daxter games. I dropped off when they got to Jack X, which I think was the
open world one,
the
right?
open world futuristic one, which I mean, some people stand by. But anyway, like I have a deep reverence for the Crash games, but also have like very little memory of like what that reverence is, other than you know what I mean. Where like some games you can pinpoint. Here's what I loved about that game. I couldn't tell you what I loved about Crash other than at the time. I liked the games, and I thought the commercials were hilarious because fuck Nintendo. Ha ha ha, PlayStation rules.
Those are some good commercials.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Definitely threw things off of roofs and went, you know, went around with like loudspeakers.
Yeah,
and
the one where he's in front of
Nintendo.
Yes! Oh, it's such a classic commercial.
Yep.
Classic.
So I played like the demo for Crash 1 and maybe a little bit of Crash 2. Can somebody tell me what the appeal is? And I don't mean that facetiously. Maybe it sounds like that, but like so Danielle, you've explained, both of you have explained the appeal of Banjo-Kazooie as being about verticality and exploration and stuff like that. I understand the appeal of Mario 3. Like I even though I'm not a big platformer fan, I like, oh, okay, I get what this game does well. What is the appeal of the Crash games? What do they do really well?
I think one of the things they did really well, and again, this is several years of memory. This is not something I've replayed recently, right, like Banjo-Kazooie. So if I'm remembering correctly, they kind of toe a line between the tighter sort of design from a 2D platformer that's like, you know, tight jumping, it feels good to jump, obstacle courses that are very directed, especially as opposed to something like Mario 64 or Banjo-Kazooie, which were much more about exploration.
Right.
You could go to all those little nooks and crannies and do all that sort of thing. This was a much more directed sort of 3D platform.
So wait, what's an example of
linear?
What are you describing as an example of that more traditional 2D, like linear? Are you just like a Super Mario game, like a Sonic game, or
yeah, like a Super Mario or a Sonic, okay, or something that, you know, there's kind of a clear path or one or two clear paths through a level.
Okay.
Mario obviously is a little bit more open than a Sonic or something like that, but this felt much more directed to me. It wasn't like, oh, if I'm recalling correctly, you didn't really have like a camera you could pull way, way, way back.
No, I don't think you had any, at least in the first game, you didn't have any camera control.
There was no DualShock yet even, right? Like there was just, analog controls, I think, by the time the first Crash came out.
So you knew where to go, basically.
Right.
You knew exactly what the game expected of you, whereas in Mario 64, at least in some levels, and Mario 64 definitely toes the line. There are some stages that are much more about exploration. There are some stages that are much more about, you kind of know where to go. They're directing your eye in certain ways. This was always, you know exactly where to go. You know exactly what to do. Now go do it. And it was tight. It was pretty tightly designed around that.
Okay. I can see the appeal.
And well, you have to remember, this came out the same year as Super Mario 64.
Sure.
So, that's right. Oh, my God, yeah.
So in some ways, where Super Mario 64 was like revolutionizing and redefining what it meant to be a platformer with the advent of sort of like 3D spaces and polygons and like this new technology that was afforded by the PlayStation and the N64, Crash Bandicoot was like, what if we kind of just kept on the same track, right? Like, and so... So even though,
yeah,
like, it switches the perspective, right? Like, the perspective is not left to right, it's front to back, but it's essentially left to right, but just sort of, like, shifted from horizontal to vertical in a sense. Mm-hmm. And so it was more or less like taking very traditional hardcore, like these games are a lot, from what I understand and from what I've been reading, because like in my memory, these games were a lot harder than what people think they are for sort of like the cutesy personality that it has. Like this isn't necessarily like a Spyro. Like I also love the Spyro games, but those aren't like super hardcore platformers.
Right.
And nor is Super Mario 64. Like it's a challenging, it's an interesting game, but it is different than, like, you know, like part of the reason people responded so much to Super Mario Sunshine's hidden stages was because they were, for the first time, Nintendo returning to, after a number of years, like really hardcore, difficult platforming, mm-hmm. because Nintendo's design ethos just went in a different direction. And Crash Bandicoot kind of kept on a similar path that had already been well trodden, which was like hardcore platforming, like specific path in which like the secrets there are secrets in the Crash Bandicoot games. Like there is like collecting things you can do, but it's like very dense within a tight space as opposed to Super Mario 64, which and Banjo-Kazooie, which we're saying here are giant wide open spaces that do have a density, but that density is packed into like specific spaces in a larger worldscape. And so I think part of the appeal of Crash Bandicoot was like, hey, did you like that thing we were doing before? Like, we're doing more of that, but like it's with polygons. And Crash was an appealing character. Like he had a lot of personality and he was funny. And this was before sort of like character action games went off a cliff. In the PS1 era.
Right. I'm very curious to see how they hold up and what people feel about them now that there's a chance to go back and play them. Like, and also how those remasters, are they just ports? Like, what's the?
There is not a single line of code from the original games. Like The Vicarious Visions, a studio that doesn't get a lot of credit for, or not, I should say, enough credit for a lot of the cool stuff they've done over the years. Go back and check out Guitar Hero for the DS, which is a fucking weird, interesting game that Vicarious Visions worked on. They've done if you go look at Vicarious Visions, like gamography, they have worked on some weird shit over the years. But they're a very talented, interesting studio, and so their approach to this was not just to do it like a typical remake or remaster. I don't know the technical reasons that they didn't use the original code, or if because what they wanted to do with the remake was it just didn't make sense to use that original code. I'm sure there's an interview that probably elaborates more, but either way, yeah, it uses no code. And I mean, it's not just high res textures. Like the animation,
I'm looking at
it now.
It looks gorgeous.
It looks really, really good. It does. The thing that it sounds like Sony's also going to try and do with Shadow of the Colossus, which is taking a game that from your memory, and when you go back to revisit it, you know, it gets a little weird because that fuzzy nostalgia in my brain had masked over like some of how this game has aged, whether it's mechanically or aesthetically. And in this case, I think this may be something we see a little more often if like Shadow of the Colossus and Crash are maybe an indication of the future is finding a way to match that fuzziness to what that game could look like now. And trying to bridge that gap.
Even just looking at this, one of the things that stands out about the original Crash Bandicoot games is that like Crash is really expressive. Like he's goofy looking, he smiles in a funny way, he kind of like scowls every now and then or like raises an eyebrow. And the new one, it's like continuing that in a way that can only happen now, where it looks just like, you know, you hear the like, oh, it looks like a Pixar movie. And I'm not saying that, but it at least looks like a DreamWorks movie. Like, it definitely has like really intense, good facial animation that just could not have been achieved then.
Eyebrows.
But like, but it evokes that same feeling that it may have evoked back then. So nice work on the looks, at least. I'm very curious to see what y'all feel about this.
I kind of can't wait to get in on this myself.
I bet.
It's gonna be a fun platformery weekend, you know, because I consider Breath of the Wild to be as much a platformer as anything else, at least the way I play it. So.
Can I ask you a very important question? How are Crash Bandicoot and the Tasmanian Devil related? Are they like cousins? Is it like a... are they like brothers? Like what's their...
They're like fifth cousins.
The exes? Okay, cousins. Got it.
Are they exes? Is that what
I don't know. They have a lot of the same moves. Like maybe they did the spin. Maybe like back in the day, Taz taught Crash how to do this cool spin move. I don't know.
You know, that's also a good theory, I think. You know, we could work with that.
Yeah, you let me know. You do some research on how Taz the Tasmanian Devil.
I'll ask him when I play the game.
You'll ask Crash. Ask Crash. Yeah. That's our new segment. Ask Crash.
Ask Crash.
Also Ask Crack. That's also our new
segment. You know, that's the other part of the segment.
Right.
It's fine.
God. All right, we should go to the old question bucket before we get out of here for our long, beautiful break.
Our crash weekend.
Our crash weekend. This one comes in from Patrick. If you have questions, you can send them to gamingadvice.com. I just realized I should say that out loud. If you have questions or comments, send them to gamingadvice.com. This one comes in from Patrick, who says, I got this from you, Patrick.
Thank you.
From Illinois. From Oak Park, Illinois. Is that close to you? Yes, okay.
I'm not going to give that information, okay. But Oak Park is a place in Illinois, I'll tell you that.
Have you ever been to Oak Park?
Yes.
Okay. Did you write this letter?
I don't think so.
Okay, I got a little behind the podcast schedule because I was flooded with E3 podcasts, so I just listened to episode 74, Purloin Your Pokemon. My main reason for writing is to share that Japanese has what I view to be the best phrase to describe the humid weather. Patrick, just so you know, we did a whole thing on humid weather and what the best word for humidity is, and like, you know, like, is it oppressive? Is it, what were some other ones, Danielle?
Muggy.
I think it was our favorite. Yeah.
That's a good word.
Swampy. Yeah. So in Japanese, there's mushi atsui, which translates to bug hot. I think that's pretty great. I apologize if a bunch of people already sent you this info. No one else sent us that info. Unfortunately, because it's a damn good piece of info.
Also, the mouthfeel of that word is really good.
Yeah, mushi atsui. Also, bug hot. Bug hot has good mouthfeel, too.
Mushi atsui seems like the words I will say after someone tracks me down, kills me, and I'm bleeding out in the alley. It's like, mushi atsui.
Bug hot.
Atsui did it.
And that's it. And that's it.
Yeah, and the killer will respond, bug hot?
Bug hot. Yeah, exactly. And then they'll be like, oh, yeah, bug hot. Let's dip deep into the bucket for this next one. I just realized it's Friday. We're supposed to be going deep into the bucket. But I wanted deep to bring buckets. Up that bug hot one before it slipped through the cracks. Give me a number from 1 to 100 and so.
35. Oh, I'm sorry.
35, you said.
Sorry.
Right?
I took it from you.
All right. It's fine.
You can have the next one.
This one comes in from Rebecca, who says, I'm so glad you talked about JRPGs this week, and I wanted to ask a question about what grinding and other tedious activities bring to a game. You talked about The Witcher and Morrowind and making your own tasks and finding your own fun in games, and I wanted to ask how grinding and tedium bring values to games, if at all. Is there value itself in the experience of having to complete hours of grinding or making outside spreadsheets for games? How does grinding in games fit into broader ideas about story versus endless quests in games like Skyrim or The Witcher, where players want hashtag content that's story-related rather than another excuse to engage with game mechanics? Keep the great work. This has been the highlight of my week bi-weekly. Sincerely, someone who enjoys playing Harvest Moon with Excel sheets and multiple handwritten notes. Thanks, Rebecca. What do y'all think?
I think if there's a satisfaction to it, then it's fine.
Yeah.
I think if that's the way you want to play, like, I am not here to judge. I put whatever 50, 60 something hours into Prey, which nobody else did. And I definitely sort of made like almost, I didn't have to draw out a map, but I definitely have a mental map of like every room in that space station and that sort of thing. And I've played so much of Zelda and I find a satisfaction in that. Some people might find that very boring. I've been going around trying to sort of farm things in Breath of the Wild. Like, oh yes, I want every kind of staminolka, whatever it's called, salmon, or I want to find the best place to find frogs. I think a lot of people would find that incredibly boring and maybe even grindy, but I want all that stuff. I find a satisfaction in that. I find a comfort in playing that game every night, you know, even if it's just to run around and find mushrooms or whatever it is. So, yeah, I think if you find a personal satisfaction in making spreadsheets, you feel that that enhances your enjoyment of the game, even if it's not exciting in the moment, that's cool.
For me, there's definitely, like, a range of how different games handle this, where you know, just seeing someone talk about it in relation to, Final Fantasy, 14, the MMO.
Yeah.
I think it was Todd Harper, who's a games academic, was saying that it is interesting how, that's a game where, you know, the most interesting parts are the story bits. But the only way to level up is to kind of go out and redo old content, right? You go out and you do instance content, and that's where you get most of your XP from so that you can level up. And because it's a game where you don't repeat, you just have one character who can become all the different classes and level them up independently, you're not like starting a new character and going through the quest line again. You're just rerunning the same instance content over and over and over again. But for whatever reason, like, that seems to work for most players. And I compare that or contrast that to like early MMOs like EverQuest, where like basically all you did was run around and kill things. And like, you're basically still running around and killing things. In both of those cases, you know, in one MMO, you might be killing, it might take you 100, you know, wolf kills to level up. And in another MMO, you might repeat the quest, kill 10 wolves 10 times to level up. But for different players, that dressing can mean a lot. I mentioned Fantasy Life before, and the way that leveling up your class in your job in Fantasy Life was that you had to complete these little tasks. So like, if you were, you know, a fighter, a warrior or whatever, it might be, you know, kill 5 goblins will give you a certain amount of points towards your job level up. And then, you know, defeat the dragon might give you an additional set of points to do that. Or if you're a miner, it might mean you have to mine, you know, 30 quartz. And then there's another level that's like, go find 5 rare minerals. And the way that was subdivided made that so much more digestible, because you were doing these little chunks of content that then you got a little checkbox for that said, hey, you're working, you're making progress, you're doing it. Every little bit doesn't necessarily count. Like, it's not like killing a goblin by itself will always advance you to your goal, but you checked the box that said killed 5 goblins. Now you get to like put that all over to the side and focus on the dragon now. And that weird subdivision just made that game so consumable to me in a way that if there had just been like, oh, everything you do gives you XP towards your job, would not have worked for me, because that would have felt like grinding. I'm really interested in how games subdivide out the rewards, like what the reward schedules are, so to speak. Like that's definitely something I pay attention to.
I don't play a ton of games with
traditional.
I played lots of JRPGs as a kid. Right. Where the grinding was appealing because I had a summer to fill.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Like when I. So it's like Final Fantasy VII. It was, you know, one of the only games in which I've maxed out the clock, you know, 9999999, because in order to do everything to get the, you know, Knights of the Round Table and things like that.
Like max out all your materia, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and I just like, I was like doing, I was grinding things just for the sake of doing it, not because it actually was meaningfully like advancing anything of the game. It was just a thing to do because I had time to fill.
A Tuesday as a kid, as a teen, where you've gone from like level 78 to 85 feels like you did something that day.
Yeah.
Even
yeah.
though you could have beat that level or that game at level 70 or whatever, you know, like it still just, it felt good.
Whereas these days, the last game that I played that really felt like it had a grind that I enjoyed was Destiny, when I joined in for the Taken King expansion, in which, you know, the actual sort of like, you know, original like strikes or missions that you're going on, you work through pretty quickly, and then what becomes part of the daily routine for that game is playing that stuff with like slight variations over and over again in order to get either different materials or different drops that can hopefully get you better weapons. And
right.
To make a grind interesting and to make something repeatable and still be fun, like there is a craft to that that is not, you know, is difficult to appreciate until you actually experience it yourself. And I mean, I played lots of the Taken King long beyond having experienced the quote unquote content that they had made for it.
Right.
And I was mostly just running things over and over again. Oh, here's the Night Strike that's available, you know, tonight. I'll run that a couple of times and see what happens. And I enjoyed the treadmill aspect of Destiny. And I think for some people, like, they, if there's a certain loop that is just, that feels satisfying, like you're okay doing it over and over again because there's a comfort in the loop itself, even if you can understand the criticism of that loop and say like, yeah, like the loop is probably kind of boring, but like sometimes boring is what you're looking for. Like maybe you don't want to sit down and learn something brand new or be challenged all that much. You're just like, I kind of like how this thing works and I know what it does and that's fine with me.
Right. Yeah, I'm definitely of that mind. So hoping that Destiny 2 does not drop the ball regarding that and actually maybe improves on that model a little bit. That's my, I don't know. That's what I'm holding out hope for. Let's do one more. Patrick, give me a number.
You said up to 100 and what?
120 or something. I'm scrolling down. It's very long. You know, it's not even, we're actually under 100. We have it down to 91.
What about 69?
Nice. Oh.
Nice. I got you. I see what you're saying.
Nice.
Uh-huh. Nice.
Nice.
I hope this is a good question. This one's from Christian. Hey.
Christian, hey. 69.
It does say 69 Christian. It does say that on my screen.
Oh.
Hello, Austin, Patrick, Danielle, and whoever else might be there. So listen, we got a good one. This already had all of our names in it. My question concerns your individual aha moments within the realm of video games journalism. Specifically, what led you to strive towards discussing video games in a more cerebral and serious manner versus simply reporting on games and their pros and cons? I vividly remember reading my first Tom Bissell article and having it completely morph the way I thought about games as a medium and led me to have one of the best experiences within a game, Spec Ops The Line. Ever since, I've been drawn to areas like the now-defunct MediumDifficulty.com and other similar sites that proliferated terms like literary narrative into the public sphere and extrapolated on the messages games send. I'm aware the Waypoint mission statement concerns itself with the society and culture of gaming, but I'm more interested in the individual strings that you followed to where you are now and any specific causes you may be championing. Thanks you all for providing such excellent content. Much love, Christian. Is there any like specific piece that or event that made you step go from I'm gonna give this game an 8 to like what is this game doing? Which, again, as always, like, I don't mean that to degrade or dismiss. I'm going to give this game an 8. I really do believe that that serves a certain purpose. There are definitely late nights where I've, like, worked all day and I come home and I'm like, oh, how did Valkyria Revolution turn? Oh, boy, bad, huh? 4? 4 out of 10? Uh-oh. Like, yeah, I've been in that place.
I'm not above scrolling to an IGN review and then going straight to the bottom and just saying, like, yo, just give me that conclusion. Like, I just don't – I'm sure you spent time on this, and I don't mean to denigrate your craft because, look, man, I do this shit for a living too, but just give me that 80 words. Like,
am I spending these dollars? Yeah. Yep. Like, what – I'm beat. I just want to know. I'm curious. Satisfy my curiosity.
How's the gameplay?
Yeah.
What's the gameplay score? Give me that gameplay score.
How are the graphics? Are the controls tight?
Is it? Do you have electric face? What was it? Was that old GamePro?
Yeah, it was like, GamePro. Had, like, five, electrified five was face? Electric face. Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Give me that electric face.
It's funny because I think part of the reason I went down this path was, one, that games just started... I'm growing up with games as they're getting complex in a way that aligned with sort of like life changes. You know, like it just seemed like as I was like hitting my late 20s and, you know, entering my 30s and games were talking about topics that were more relevant to sort of my real life. And I guess to be more pragmatic about it, like I intend to do this for a long time, you know, like God willing, and I can't. Like, I need something more to grasp onto if I'm going to find a way to not only find things to write about, but to be happy and interested. And in order to do that, I needed to start finding a depth to games that went beyond the stuff I had done for years when I got started, because that's what I've been trained on, and that's what I was used to. But, like, I needed to find a depth. I needed to find other things to sink my teeth and my brain into, because that's just not – if I start thinking about where I'm at when I'm 45,
right.
Like, I need to be looking further and, like, what is going to motivate me to be interested in getting up every morning and doing this, you know, 15 years from now? And it's things like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How about absolutely. You, Danielle?
Well, I made this life choice to go to graduate school, which was maybe not the most intelligent economic choice. For myself to make, especially not in the field that I sort of went to grad school for. I went to film school for my master's, right. And that was, yeah. But anyway, that came with a whole bunch of, I was a production student, but that came alongside a lot of, you know, sort of visual studies, visual culture courses that kind of made me have to think in that fashion about entertainment in general. And so I sort of started, you know, I would never consider myself a games academic or an academic person, even though I teach college.
Yeah,
I know, but I'm not an academic. I teach practice. I don't really teach studies that much. But I had to take the studies classes, and I enjoyed them, and I had fun, and it certainly made me think in a certain way, and it made me sort of assign a lot of value to thinking in that way, and assign a lot of value to sort of the cultural messages that are imparted by literally everything in your life, including ads and that sort of thing.
Right.
So... I started thinking that way, and that came right around the same time a lot of the sort of brainy gamer sphere was starting up. Like, I started grad school in 2006, which I think is right around kind of when that, you know, there was
all the blogs,
a whole confluence of people who were writing, like, really intelligent, really, really, really smart things about games and what games kind of meant. And that was at that peak of the middle 2000s, where a lot of this stuff was very new and very... This was before we were lamenting every 2 years that everybody said, oh, we don't have a history of game criticism. You know, this is the first time that felt like it was happening in a large way. Yeah. So that all kind of came together at the right time for me.
I definitely feel like I had been writing up this way about games since I was a kid and was trying to justify why I connected to games so much. Like,
totally.
I absolutely wrote in, you know, junior high or something about the morality system of Bushido Blade, right? Like, which was about as much justification for me in the time I was spending as it was like the authority figures in my life who knew that, like, oh, Austin's so smart, but he plays games nonstop. You know, like, definitely that sort of thing. And then, like, took an arc to where I moved away from that particular style of writing and instead towards a little bit closer to what I do now, which is, like, assume that these things are important, but definitely was, and I've said this before, like, kind of a prick about it and kind of just, like, my writing was, like, very, like, I don't care if it doesn't have an audience. I'm writing the capital T truth, and and a lot of that came probably from, or like the capital T truth slash my own take and my own personal story, and like a lot of that probably came from really loving at the time like the rise of new games journalism, you know, the Kieran Gillens and the Tim Rogers and the like all of the sort of like very personal narrative meets kind of low level, or not even low level, but like personal life philosophy stuff, right? That didn't have a word count and went on way too long and found an audience in other young people who were just desperate to read 8,000 words on Super Mario Brothers 3. Like, and that was me. And so that stuff started to push me into thinking about that was like, let me just barf onto this page. Let me just get every thought out, which was an important step for me for sure. And I think there is still value in that stuff. Like, I still look at that stuff from time to time and find phrases that are really good. And then it was probably writers like Jeff Green and N. Guy Kroll, people like Robert Ashley, Sean Elliott, who pushed my focus to get tighter and to say, like, what do you say in 1,200 words? What do you say in 800 words? I think I was actually pretty good at that for a little while. And then I went to grad school and it all blew up again because suddenly I was writing 35,000 words and 50,000 words. and then eventually, like, I think it just kind of wrapped back around. Like, all of
turn
those things,
this boy into a blogger.
And then now I'm back. Yeah. I'm back trying to blog again and it's hard. It's hard, man. Well, I'll get there, Patrick. I'll get there. I have
6 whole
months.
Got
it. You can do by the end of the year. I'll be blogging. First,
there's already been progress.
You got to give me
been plenty of progress
any time so that I can. The things that I've written recently have been bloggier with a few exceptions, but I just don't have writing time at all right now. So, and then, you know, just the thing is, like, I could just name so many people who helped me and pushed me and helped shape my voice. Like, obviously being at Giant Bomb and working with people like Brad Shoemaker and Alex Navarro and Jeff Gerstmann helped me a lot as a writer. Like, being able to show stuff now to Patrick and Danielle and get input helps a lot. Like, I think about people like Cameron Kunzelman, who is one of our columnists. Like, Cameron is the one who got me a gig at Paste, right? Like a freelance gig at Paste. Like, Cameron was the one who was like, oh, I really want to co-write this with Austin. And that was the first piece I wrote on Paste was like, I think that might have been the Indie 3. We wrote about Indie 3 together. And then from there, I got to write about Twitch culture and labor. And then I got to write about games criticism from there. And so like, there are so many people who I'm grateful for who both either materially helped me by like giving me opportunities or influenced my writing because I read theirs and was like, yo, this is actually the shit. Like, this is that shit for real. There's like too many to name. And I guess my thought is just find that inspiration where you can, and like hone in on what you like about someone else's work if you're going that route. And then do your best not to just mimic it. Like, you'll find a phrase that maybe you think isn't what someone else would write, but like sticks in your brain a little bit. Let it stick in your brain. Like, be a little more conversational or a little more formal or a little more whatever. Like, find what that voice is and then work on it for yourself. That's, I think, has worked for all three of us, for sure.
Yeah.
So that's my advice. I think that's going to also Barth reading Barth's mythologies. This is actually 100% true. It's like reading Barth's chapter on professional wrestling was like, oh shit, like I can write about anything and be smart about it. Fuck yeah, let's do it. So that's my other one, is like finding people who write about pop culture broadly in interesting ways. So like sites like Grantland were huge for me when I was in like grad school, was like, oh, they're writing about, you know, professional wrestling, or they're writing about, you know, advertising in a way that's really, or sports, obviously, in a way that's really intriguing and thoughtful and often political, or at least engaged with the wider world. That stuff is huge. Like, find stuff that isn't just games journalism. I say it a lot, but I'm going to say it again. Find stuff that isn't just games journalism to read and take inspiration from. It will help you a lot. All right. That is going to do it. If you have questions, you can send them to gamingadvice.com. You can find me on the internet at Austin_Walker. Danielle, what about you?
Danielle R.I., also known as Auntie Knuckles.
Auntie Knuckles, thank you for joining me yesterday on Breakfast in Battlegrounds and watching me kill some people with Uzis. Patrick, what about you?
You can find me at Patrick Klupik.
You can also find Patrick out on that murder island, on that great big murder island in the computer sky, killing people. You can find everything we do at waypointadvice.com. You can find us on Twitter at twitter.com/waypoint, facebook.com/waypoint, youtube.com. Nope. Facebook.com/waypointvice, youtube.com/waypointvice. You can find the archives that we did of our Battleground streams. The ones from this week, I think, are not up yet because our production team has been super busy working on another project. If you missed the earlier ones, if you enjoyed Patrick and me talking about Battleground,
they should be on Twitch, though.
They should all be on Twitch. That is true. Yeah. So you go to Twitch and find the archives there, or find them at youtube.com/waypointvice for the older ones. So check those out. That's going to do it for us this week. I want everyone to have a safe holiday weekend if you're in the U.S. I want everyone to have a safe non-holiday weekend if you're not in the U.S. I want everyone to relax and rest and just feel good about something. Find something to feel good about. That's what I'm going to say. Thanks to Tim Barnes for producing this, probably TimBarnes451 on Twitter. And thanks to Bowen for letting us use his track, Miss You, off the EP Pale Machine. Find out more info about that at waypoint.zone/BOEN. Danielle, what do we say to them?
Be good or be good at it.
Peace.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.